Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 391 and part two of my conversation with Minneapolis-based freelance percussionist, educator, and a director of marketing and percussionist for the 10th Wave Chamber Music Collective, Ari Isamora. Let's get right to it. If you caught part one, which I hope you did, last week, you know that we got to hear from Ari about her career in teaching both piano and percussion, her work with the 10th Wave Collective in Minneapolis, her life as a new mom, growing up in the Minneapolis area, and her time as an undergrad at St. Olaf College. Today, on part two, we're picking up right where we left off, where Ari will talk about the injuries she suffered from overuse during her undergrad and her challenging recovery, her years at Boston Conservatory of Music, and her time in the Boston area, her decision to return to Minneapolis, along with the usual end to the interviews. Additionally, and this is in the close to the episode, Ari points out that if folks are interested in hearing music made by 10th Wave, there are a few YouTube clips of recitals and performances from during the pandemic that are on their webpage and can be found by clicking Listen and Watch on the 10th Wave website, which is at 10thwave.org or 10thwave.org. Find it there. All right, here we go with the interview. We recorded this conversation over Zoom on February 29th, 2024, and it begins right now.
So you mentioned that you overuse happens with all the playing you're doing, and then you have to take a break. So was it a situation where you were you were not paying attention to how your body was feeling? Was it that you just kind of did you like just take a lot of aspirin to just manage? What ended up, because I can't imagine that. Or did something snap? I mean, like, because I mean, there's lots of things that can happen where you're like, I actually can't play anymore.
That's a good question. It came gradually.
Okay.
And senior year, I in the spring, I was playing Velocities. Of course, I was playing Safa.
Oh, easy pieces. Good. Yep.
Easy pieces.
Did you do the Druckmann? Was that in? Is that in playing that too? Or
I was, that was the year before that.
Oh, okay. Of course. Yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I was playing those pieces. They're really chop heavy, you know, really choppy, really loud and fast, which is great. And then plus all the piano playing, right?
Right.
Playing Brahms sonatas and stuff.
Well, there you go. That's for you.
Yeah. Those pieces, the two, especially Velocity and Safa, though, those were done by early April. And I was still okay. But I was starting to feel something where, you know, I was constantly practicing and in a cold room, too. The AC was blessed all the time. I think that was also a factor. But, yeah, I mean, they need it on for the instruments. So, yeah, so then I would start to feel a lot more tired at the end of the day. And they were just, like, every day my arms were just toast. They're just fried. And then I could tell they weren't recovered by the next day. But I still need to practice. So,
right, of course.
You know, I didn't really know how to practice pieces like that without playing.
Yeah.
You know, or even like, you know, mimicking it or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just thought I just needed to play. And then there was a concerto competition that spring as well. So I was playing a concerto for vibraphone and marimba by Mio. And then by May, I was taking ibuprofen to like get through the concert. You know, by the time graduation came, I think I could handle a triangle. I couldn't carry, I could barely hold snare drum sticks.
Mm.
Yeah. So by that time it was like gone. But yeah, so it just got weaker and weaker, like exponentially. But, you know, it's not like I couldn't finish anything. My recitals did all my juries. So, you know, and then I couldn't play piano. So I can't, like, I couldn't accompany people by that point. But yeah, yeah. So that was a gradual thing. And then I graduated. So I didn't have to worry about playing immediately.
But you said that it took, when you were getting back into it, you would do like minutes.
Yeah, that was excruciating.
I bet.
So the first few months, I questioned my life choices. And
sounds right. That sounds like post-undergrad. Right. Yes, yes.
Right, right. It was just, I came out with a performance major. Why? I'd be at home and just kind of reflecting, right, on everything that happened, thinking about my place in, you know, this world of what am I supposed to do with this?
Right.
And is it worth getting back up into shape? And my inherent, my body is screaming like, yes, like, please play again. I cannot, like, you know, we can't not do it. Like, we have to at least go toward that forever. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
So I couldn't deny that, but I couldn't play. So I rested. I didn't play at all. I didn't listen to any music for like 2 months because it would just remind me of how sad it is. It was fine. I was not dead. I was like, no one died. Like, it was not a big deal in a way. I have really supportive parents and friends. It was kind of nice to be away from everything for a little bit. Oh, I can't play, you know. And then slowly I was thinking, I do have to start at some point, or like figure out how. Yeah, I was eager to get back, but I didn't know how. So I did a lot of acupuncture and a lot of physical therapy. And on and off of those things for 2 years, 2.5 years or so. Yeah. And just slowly getting them back into shape. Because what was happening was this kind of neuropathy, like a little bit of neurological spasm, or I don't know. It's like a signal where it's not hurting, but it feels like pain. So your brain is trying to protect you from the pain, or protect you from injury,
right?
Which is why they're sending you pain signals. So is it real or is it just your brain? And that was the game for a little bit. And then slowly going from 0 to 5 was hard, because you have to expose yourself to the music and play and remind yourself that you have to play, but you have to stop. That's hard too.
Yeah.
Because you miss it so much. You play 15 minutes and then you hurt yourself and you can't play for 3 more days. Right. So you have to pace it based on what you want. Yeah. What you need. Right. Because when I'm recovering, I could tell my muscles decayed. Because if I kept up my muscles, then it would have been easier to recover maybe. But then my brain wouldn't have understood what's going on. It's still like, why are you still playing? You have to stop right now, you know? So I just had to like start from scratch in a way. And it worked out, you know. But during that time, I was able to reflect and kind of recharge not only just my mind, but also my soul spiritually. Like, it's just all part of being a whole human instead of just like a drum machine. So, right. Yeah.
Or just a piano. I mean, a piano machine too, obviously.
Right. Yeah. I still wanted to pursue music. And then I went to grad school, or I was able to audition, but I also went to Zalzburg Marimba Festival back in the day. But I was inspired by a lot of the students there and the artists, and it took that community for me to get back up and think that it's a viable future. Like, there are so many pieces to play,
right?
And so many people to meet. In Minnesota by yourself, it doesn't seem that way.
Yeah.
You know, the marimba solo community is very small here. Yeah. So, you know, I would be an ambassador for that here, not like another community member. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Just to kind of the kind of close the book on the, you know, the recovery, did mm-hmm. you figure out for yourself, did you figure mm-hmm. out, okay, like I have to pay attention. Like, do you notice that you have to pay attention to when your body is, I would assume that you're now hyper aware. Like if anything, I would hope mm-hmm. if anything's going wrong, you're on it immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yes. If I play a really challenging piece, like I did end up playing Merlin and all those guys. But you know, I did it carefully and I did it sustainably in a way, where I feel like, my brain was way ahead, of the studying, so that when I do actually need to play it, I don't have to work so hard because, I just know where to focus my strength. Overuse and all those things happen because of, poor practicing habits, I think. That and just like trying to prove myself to myself. Yeah. So whenever I have a hard piece or something that takes a lot of endurance, I do take a lot of breaks and I study my own recordings a lot. Yeah. And I think studying my recordings cuts down my practicing like 40%.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's just so much easier. And I'm a teacher, so I have my teacher mindset. And if I'm hearing my own playing, like I'm pretty brutal. So
same. Yeah.
I get so mad. Like you played that wrong again.
Yes.
Right. And I'm like, okay, I will get it right.
I'm very much the same way. And a lot of times they'll be like, you know, what are you practicing? You know, when I go down to the practice rooms and I'll be like, well, I'm just trying not to suck. And then they're like, how's it going? I'm like, oh, today. No, I pretty much suck today. Maybe tomorrow I'll be like half decent. You know, like that's like my level. I'm like, yeah. I could play that in front of people and not feel sick, you know?
Yeah. 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 I hope someday, I think I'll give myself a little more credit, but I'm not sure that's today.
when you get to Boston, is there a culture shock to being in that part of the country?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. How did you know? What was the first thing that happened? You're like, oh, not Minneapolis anymore.
Once I moved there, it was oversaturated with musicians. Musicians everywhere, you know, in the bars and cafes and restaurants, like, or on the street, you see kids with cymbal bags, their stick bags.
Yeah.
You see like guitar, yeah, everything, you know, and then, people from Boco with their instruments, like, you know, they're carrying their tuba on their bag. Like it's just school culture. Mm-hmm. And, what I loved about a good shock was that, out of, what, like 24 students in Boco, half of them were females.
Mm.
And it was funny because it was two majorities and then some minority, but half of the students were Asian females and the other half were white males. And then wow. There was like a few that are like in between,
mm-hmm.
are like one or the other, right?
Yeah.
That was crazy. That was so fun. There were students from Taiwan, from Malaysia, from Japan. And yeah, and then there were some Asian Americans, so like myself. So then culturally, yeah, it was super fun to hang out. And we would just, we would eat together and cry together. You know? So the musical shock, I guess. Was well, first of all, everybody was better than me.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. That welcome was, to grad school. That's
right. It's so exciting, you know.
It is. Like, yeah.
I'm ready to learn. You know.
Yeah.
How can I be better than you? No. How can I improve my own artistry so that mm-hmm. I can make a statement, artistic statement. The attention to sound, the attention to repertoire. No, those are all, those were all new to me. It was never to that emphasis or to that degree ever before that. I just play the standards, play them really well, you know. But now it's like every decision matters. Yeah. You can't just wait for your teacher to pick your piece anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Or I mean, tell you musically what you have to do with it.
Right. Right. Yeah. So BoCo was really nice because I had so many opinions from teachers. I had different people that I would play for, and then they would all say their own insight of how the piece should go. And that was really helpful for me. You know, people just normally played 5-octave Burma.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
That's so great. So yeah, it felt like home in a lot of ways, where I can just be myself as an artist and people would understand what I'm trying to talk about. So coming out of that, now it's just like, oh, you're a marimba player. How do you hold two? Yeah.
Right.
It's back to that. Right. Yeah. Which, you know, it's changing. People are taking art more seriously, more in depth than that now, but yep. Yeah. It's a process.
So yeah, your ability to play Merlin is like, they'd be like, yeah, I played that 5 years ago. So
right, right. Yeah. No, okay. No. I remember we were saying Velocities is like your high school prom picture.
Like, yeah, that's where you're at. There. Yeah.
Like, yeah, we don't need to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. I've said before, Velocities is one of the pieces that the instant I finished it, I played it on one of my doctoral recitals. The instant I finished it, I was like, never again. Do not. I'm not picking that piece up ever again. And I still have it, and I don't plan on it.
I mean, it's a crowd pleaser.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, you know, I love that journey for you, that kind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is one of those.
I love that for you.
Yes, exactly. Very much so. Oh, that's awesome. Tell me about lessons with Nancy.
Oh, they were great. She would always be ready for like practical insight. In a way, it was just produced like a good sound, and let's talk from there. Mm-hmm. And you know, picking repertoire that she cared about or not cared about, she didn't really mind. You know, she would have suggestions. And then she would really see through the technique. She would see past the technique, because that's not the concern. It's more about who you are as a player.
Right.
And so, you know, she has hundreds of repertoire because she commissioned a ton of them. Right.
Yeah.
And then she would kind of fit them like clothes, like this might look good on you, you know, you know, that kind of
thing. I like that. Yeah.
So you kind of shop for repertoire in that sense of like, she knows this one piece that might look really good with your playing. And she was really good at it too. Like, how do you know I would like this piece? Right. So, you know, and of course she would make sure you're responsible for your own playing, and you can't just be, you can't just say, oh, I didn't have time. Like, there's none of that. Right. Or you have to have something ready for your lesson. Mm-hmm. And the lesson can't be this note is wrong. It has to be, let's think about the voicing in this polyphonic passage. Like, what the phrase is not ending here. Like, what am I hearing and what are you saying? And are they the same? So a lot of that. Yeah. And you know, soft malice.
Sure. Yeah.
Play a soft balance and listen to the fundamental of the tone of the mallets or of the marimba, and really just less is more. that kind too. If it's a textural piece where you're making some kind of ambient sound with fluttering rolls or something, you know, that's different. But other than that, it's a lot of sparse but refined, and you're making a statement. So a big one was See a Thursday. That one is so weird.
It is so weird.
there are so many weird parts in it, but every part has like it's a story, right? And it just takes you everywhere, and the sporadicness of it, and then it's just a lot more modern in a sense. And and being able to own that was challenging and really fulfilling. Like, what are you really listening to? Are you listening for the 5-on-4s? Are you, you know, are you listening for technical things, or are you just listening for someone that just like sounds like they're pissed, and then it's gonna like, you know, but it's like this quiet anger, or like, you know, and she doesn't get all metaphorical like that, really. It's just like trying to make sense of it, artistically. She's a great teacher for balancing that. It's not about like, oh, well, do you hear the river streaming in this song? You know, it's not like that at all. And it's also not like, oh, but you missed that note in B2.
Right.
Yeah. So it's in between there. Yeah. In like a really intellectual way. You know, I was used to lessons being, how can I impress you more? And how can I talk intelligently about this piece? And I would say a question, and then I would feel so stupid after that, because she'd just be like, what are you talking about?
But my paradiddles are super fast.
So,
1-4-3-2-1-2-3-2. Like, look at these permutations. I'm just got so fast.
Oh, yeah. She's all about the basics. She's all about making sure that you have what it takes to make a statement without all the notes. You know, you don't need that many notes to be an artist. So she has this fundamental, you know, her book, the Format Marimba Playing book. So she goes through those exercises that all the reading. Man, I was, when I first got that book in high school, I was so mad that I had to read a percussion book. I just wanted to play the notes, right? And just get it done with. But those, all those notes in there are very practical. And especially the ones that precede each passage in the 50 exercises in the beginning. Being able to get the point, accomplish the mission for that etude is super important. And I think that, it's a whole semester of it with her that I think all the marimba majors do. I took it. I mean, at BoCo, you can be a marimba major or a percussion major. And I did the percussion major, but I did a lot of marimba in it. So I took a lot of lessons with Nancy. As for marimba playing, there's so much more depth than like accuracy. Mm-hmm. And it's so much more about the spaces in between those notes. And also good playing.
So were you studying with other people than Nancy while you were there?
Absolutely. So Sam Solomon was my main teacher as percussion for the master's of percussion. Keith Aleo was there my first year, and then he went to Interlochen after that. Mm. And then he was replaced by Doug Perkins.
Oh, yeah.
And so with Doug, I went to Aspen and Vail and all those places to play Inuksuit with him, because he was arranging all of those, or he was organizing all of those, which was super fun. I love playing Siren, but I need to plug for that. Yeah. And then there was also one at in Montana called Tippett Rise. And Tippett Rise, I don't know if you've heard of it. They have like a music festival. It's a tiny place in rural beautiful Montana, and it, you know, rolling hills, you know, with the backdrop of the Rockies, and there are, you know, lots of rich people there that would go to like see some modern music or some Yeah. So, you know, a piano recital or whatever. Yeah. It's kind of like the, it's very artsy. There's some really like extravagantly huge statues, like modern statues and sculptures that are around that range. Mm. So you see like all the, it's massive, but you have to kind of go around to each artwork in a truck and this, you know, rural, this little guide, he'll drive you to all those places and tell you about it. But yeah, so like, you know, so Doug got me into more of the participative and more like immersive percussion.
Sure.
And new music in that sense, right? Of a soundscape.
Yeah.
And being in that. So yeah, that opened the doors to a lot more collaboration for me. Just being able to work as a team to create an environment instead of like, here's a solo piece. Yeah, that helped. So in the masters, it's not just getting better at your instrument. It's about being able to work with people better.
Yeah.
And being able to understand what each other's goals are. Working with Sam was very technical. It was very fun to work with him because he just had so many ideas. About the music. Take any piece of music and just shape it in a way that makes it work. And that's similar to Nancy in a sense, but he was a lot more technical. His style of playing was reflected in his teaching too. Everything, all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, that kind. With that, there was this precision and like pristine playing that came up. That was very clean and really like delightful. Yeah. And, you know, if you had played something and you play it, he will take you seriously, you know, and that's great because you want to be taken seriously when you're in school. You don't want to be a joke. Yeah. Being able to play the way that you really want to make the piece sparkle. Like he was really good at that. And it wasn't like philosophical at all either. Yeah, it was very practical. He wrote the book, How to Write for Percussion.
Oh yeah. I read it, used it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's just so good at, articulating himself. And that's true as a person too. He's a family guy. So, you know, sometimes his kids would show up to random events at BoCo, which was always fun. So you can tell he's not like a total monster. So I feel like people are intimidated by him, but he's actually like super awesome.
Mm.
So I was glad to have spent time with him as a student. So yeah.
Awesome. You said there was a thought before you moved back to Minnesota. You're like that you were like, maybe I'll stick around. Mm-hmm. Was that like a real serious thing, or were you like, I'm kind of ready to go back?
No, it was real because I could see my life there too. There was a community there, and there are people like me that were graduating out of BoCo and getting into the real world, you know, finding an apartment, finding gigs, finding teaching, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, I could be there to be a part of that. But at the same time, my nephew was born back at home. And, but I can't be like, oh, it's your fault that I'm back or anything like that. It's just,
right, sure, yeah.
There was a sense of, family that was one of the things that made me think, you know, I want to see him grow up.
Yeah.
And I want to be part of my family when all this is happening. And then the part of funding as well, right? Like it's just so hard to get by in Boston. And in Boston is also, there wasn't enough space. Mm-hmm. It's much, you know, the space between houses, the size of the rooms, the size of the streets. There was a snowpocalypse when I was in Boston too, where there was like 5 feet of snow and it was pretty dangerous to leave.
Yeah.
You know, we just shut in for 3 days and everything's canceled.
Yeah.
Remember snow days? Oh, okay.
I miss those. They're great.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's virtual now. Like, what? Yeah. Still school? It's the worst.
I know.
Anyway. Yeah.
Well, you know what I've heard, it's you're reflecting other things I've heard from people who've studied in that area or lived there for a little while, is that it's also really hard to get on like sub lists and get work because there's just so many people there, and like you said, they don't leave, so you're just now, you're like, you finish and you're like, all right, now I'm at the bottom of a list that who knows when it's going to clear up. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was a major concern. I wasn't going to. So I saw a percussion ensemble of recent graduates, and that's not even like last year. It's like 4 or 5 years ago graduates. Uh-huh. And they had to, you know, pay money to perform a percussion ensemble concert, right? They had to get the venue. They had to schlep everything into the theater, play this random concert, and get like, you know, 30 people in the door maybe. And then it's like a one and done, right? Yeah. And it's like, it looked like so much work and they seem exhausted. And if you want to do that all the time, and yeah, it's like, well, good luck. If that's what you choose for your life, you know, cool. Like you don't, cause if you can live off of, way less because you're so fired up about what you're doing, that's what,
and you want to stay there.
Yeah. That's what it seemed like to me for that. Yeah. The competition was so high. You need a car if you want to be like useful,
right?
That means you need to buy a car, you need a place for your car, you need to constantly fight for street parking because no one has garages, and everything's just so expensive, you know. But what I really appreciated of that city was that everybody was so passionate and everybody is really smart and really driven and like maybe a little angry.
Well, it is Boston, so that's kind of built in.
Yeah. Like, why are you angry? Yeah. So that drive was really helpful to learn that I am not that driven.
Or not driven in that way, at least, maybe.
In that sense, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thrive where I can be a leader, where in Boston, I think it's really hard to be one because everybody else is so good. So, and I'm not saying that like I have to be the best in the room or anything like that.
Sure.
It's just where in a situation, in a given situation where there's a problem, like if I can help lead the group to a solution, right? But if I am the group that needs the solution, I don't think I can thrive that well. So, yeah. So it's much easier to create my own road in a way in Minnesota. So yeah, I mean, Boston is very transient in that sense, but I mean, there are a lot of young people and a lot of ideas, so like it was an experience that I don't regret at all. Yeah, I needed that to put me in my place for one thing, but also the community that it can be and the people that stay there, definitely, you know, they thrive in that situation, in that atmosphere. So, but that is just one city and it can kind of be a bubble for sure.
Well, Ari, I finished with a segment called Random Ask Questions.
Okay.
First question is, you've talked about this kind of briefly, but I'm going to kind of, this is one of the, I kind of open the floor with your experiences navigating the percussion world as a woman.
Great.
Just kind of go where you want with that.
It's funny you say that, that's random because,
okay. So that question's not random.
Okay. So, actually did a clinic called Women in Percussion. Mm. Yeah. And that was this past January with the Minnesota Percussion Association. And I'll be presenting that clinic 4 more times this year in the spring. So anyway, being a woman and once people know that I'm a classically trained percussionist, they just don't think I play drum set. Mm. Right. It's just like, never, you know, like, don't even try, you know. And I'm not saying that I'm good at it, but I'm good at it. Mm-hmm. I can play just fine. Thank you. Yes. I probably notice more different things when it comes to the percussion section. And when one person, most likely male, is dominating the environment for leadership, right? Because if you have, say, a clarinet section, right? You have your firsts, you have your seconds, and maybe your thirds in the band. And people already know their place in it, right?
Right.
With percussion, it's kind of a free-for-all per piece. Right. Yes. Of like, who's going to play this part and et cetera. So then they're just one principal, and then everybody else kind of like fights for like the better parts, whatever. Mm-hmm. And in that, it's easier to just be the person that can do anything and will be willing to do anything, where I think that some men are more likely to be stubborn about what they want to play, and that's it. I'm not speaking this for everybody, but mm-hmm. A lot of women percussionists tend to just be there to take care of the group, to make sure that everybody's in harmony, and it's at peace. And it's like, okay, you need someone to do this part, I'll do this part, that's fine, I'll do it. You know, and it's never really about what you want to do. So it's kind of working around alpha males and stuff. And that is it's frustrating, but it is pretty common. Of course, every situation is different. So I grew up not being, not being discriminated, really. Or like, I don't know like a particular time where like, oh, you're a girl, so you can't play this. It was never really like that, because again, I worked really hard and I was seen as a leader, so it was easy to just demand that authority in a sense. You know, when the percussion section is stereotyped or generalized in different categories of which one is more feminine or which one's more masculine, of which instruments are you able to play, right? And then, it's all about the assignments, I think. Mm-hmm. And if like the most quote unquote competent person is like a male and they can't play snare drum, they're like mad about it. And then the most competent female is somehow on the mallets, and it's like, why?
Right.
That kind of thing. And the notion of like, oh well, girls are usually on the mallet instruments, and boys are usually on the drums, and the boys don't want to learn the bell part, so they don't learn it, and then they're always on a snare drum, right? They hog it, and then, or else they'll quit band or something like that. And it's like, well, I guess we'll take the bells, because yeah. Otherwise we'll run out of people, and like it won't function without our sacrifice, that kind of thing. So I've seen that time and time again. And sometimes it's true in like community orchestras or regional. And it's like, well, when will this end? And I think with more women leadership, of course, there's more equality in it. And I mean, you know, just because a woman is a principal doesn't mean it's going to be like perfect either. We all still have to choose the lesser evil sometimes, you know,
right.
When assigning parts. But yeah, when I was last December, I was invited to sub for the timpani part for Duluth Symphony, and playing principal timpani or playing timpani for an orchestra, or being asked to, that felt like a big step to me, because playing timpani does it, like, how many women timpanists are there? And I would see, I would maybe see women in the percussion section, but how many are playing timpani in an orchestra, right? Yeah. Like, that is also a field where it's very minor, it's majority male. And so I don't know, hopefully it will just keep progressing where more orchestras have 50-50 of male and female, or just more, just representation of different genders, not being restricted to one. I read in some research that it's 50-50 for most professional orchestras in most of the sections, except for the low brass and percussion. Those are where it's still like very, very male heavy. In a sense, the culture of it, because in every gig, there are only about 4 or 5 percussionists, right?
Right.
So it's not like hanging out with 20 violin players. Mm-hmm. It's just a one and done. Every time I'm subbing for an orchestra or a band, it's a different experience, a different group of people. Right. So then you can't really assume anything. But yeah. If you feel like you need to assimilate into the dude bro culture of like percussion, then I feel like you kind of lose yourself if you can see that difference. And you don't need to change yourself to be anything, to be a better percussionist. And you do not need to be less feminine if you're, or like for me, like I don't need to act macho, mm-hmm. to prove that I can play those parts, right? Like the snare drum is just as feminine as it is masculine, or whatever it is, yeah.
It's just a drum. Like
it's just a drum. Yeah. So. So I hope, as I do more of those clinics and workshops too, that more of a minority can feel at home in the percussion section and not feel like they'll have to prove anything, in a sense, just because, or clean up after other people that don't know how to like be versatile.
I like that term, clean up after.
Yeah. play your 8 notes, man. Can't you play your scale? Sorry. Yep.
Is that a flashback you just had?
It's all just, coming back in little flashbacks.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny. All right. Some other questions. These are not going to be percussion related. But has anyone ever nailed an impression of you? And if so, how'd they do it?
I wish. I don't really know. No, I don't think I've had that moment. I wish I could say that someone has done that. But I think the closest I get is when a student copies my mannerisms.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
What do they do?
When I'm talking about something, mm-hmm. and then I say, okay, right. And then I try to move on. But So when I say, okay, that means I need to change the subject. Like, this is happening. Okay. Now let's do this. And I heard a student down like, wait, I do that. that's how I do it. So
that's good.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Nice. What's the most impractical item of clothing you own?
I definitely bought a prom dress that was $36. And I still have it in my, this was 5 or 6 years ago. Well past prom time, but I was it's so useless, but it's so pretty. And it was $100 when I first saw it at the store. And then, 2 years later, it's in the clearance, like final, right? And it's my size. I have to have it. I looked at my fiance, husband, you know, now husband, but fiance at the time, like, buy this. Okay. You know, sometimes it's just, so I mean, I did wear it to my bridal shower. So,
oh, nice.
It was used once, as you mentioned. Yes, it was.
Yes.
Very, but absolutely useless beyond.
That's good. I like that. That's what I want. That's awesome. So there'll be a two-parter on this. So first part is, okay, what's your biggest kitchen mess up?
When I microwaved an egg.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I thought it would work because I cracked a little bit.
Okay.
Like a hole, right?
Oh, you didn't go like scrambled, you know, no, and throw it in like that. You just put the egg in.
Shell.
Okay.
With a little hole in it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Did not work.
Did it explode? What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those, like, you see it in the screen, you know?
It's coming right for you.
Yeah. That just exploded. Yeah, wow. Yeah.
That's good.
Otherwise,
that's a good one. That's a good
yeah.
one. Okay, so the flip side is, what's a like a signature dish or something like you would make for guests that you're like, this is what I do, this is what I'm making?
Well, when people ask for it, it's a Japanese dish called okonomiyaki. And it's basically a savory pancake.
Oh.
Yeah. And with pork belly and a batter and cabbage and, and other pickled things on top with mayonnaise and sauce. So it's like a street food and from Hiroshima. Yeah. It's something you can make on your grill or your griddle. Or stovetop, you know, and yeah, it's always really hearty and everybody loves it.
Is it quick? Like, is it a pretty quick thing to make, or does it actually take a while to kind of set it up? Maybe
it's not like, you know, hours and hours or anything. It's just another, you know, it's just another dinner meal kind of thing. If you have the right, supplies or the ingredients, you're the right ingredients, it's fine.
What's like a kind of a specific Japanese ingredient that's like you would have to maybe search for to make with it? Or is there not one necessarily? It's just combination.
Yeah, there is. So the toppings are generally dried seaweed, not nori, black nori that wraps up sushi. It's called aonori, but it's like that translates to blue seaweed.
Okay.
But it's like a flaky parsley like kind of seaweed, and that's very fragrant, and then it's called beni shoga, which is red ginger. It's like it's not the sushi ginger, it's not like the pink flaky one, but the pickled, it's more like strips of ginger.
Oh,
that are hot pink. And then tonkatsu sauce. So tonkatsu is not like, so some people think tonkotsu and tonkatsu are the same, but they're completely different. tonkotsu is a ramen flavor,
mm-hmm,
or like a broth flavor. And yeah, tonkatsu is breaded pork.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So, you
know. So T-O-N-K-O-T?
Yeah.
That's the first one. That's the broth.
That's the broth. Yeah. Kotsu is bone.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah. So tonkotsu is pork bone.
Okay.
Yeah. Tonkatsu is breaded pork.
Okay.
Makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So the sauce for that is like a fruity soy. It's like basically ketchup and soy sauce put together. But it's like specialized. It's called tonkatsu. Or a similar thing is okonomi sauce, which is the specialized okonomiyaki sauce.
Mm.
It's like a dark brown sauce, kind of like barbecue sauce, but not as tart, tangy. Yeah.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Yeah. Oh, that makes me so hungry.
All right. What's a great movie and what's a terrible movie?
Terrible, you mean it's supposed to be terrible and you're supposed to enjoy it because it's terrible.
It could be. It could also just be something maybe you were hoping was going to be good and then it was bad.
So oh,
like, okay. It could be like you could kind of go in either way. I'm not.
Okay. A good movie is Arrival.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That alien one with the languages. Yeah. That one I loved.
Yeah.
That and Parasite.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I watched it 3 times and I freaked out all so good. Terrible movie. I was stupid to think that it was going to be good. And it was Snakes on a Plane. with Samuel Jackson.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I thought he's like a good actor.
Oh, he is, but like,
yeah.
That was like a money grab.
Right, yeah. Right. I was like in the theater and my other like college guy friends are just cracking up and I'm just like angry. Like, this is so bad. I want to leave you, but I don't have a ride home.
Right, you're stuck. Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. Well, it's all about the line. The one line is the whole
the one line. The line.
Yeah. The rest of it, whatever.
Yeah. I didn't know it was going to be a bad movie until like 15 minutes in.
Oh.
It took me that long to realize like this is not a good movie. This is terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, looking back, you know, I'll never watch it again, but I think it's funny.
Yeah, yeah, no, I hear you. All right, what's a favorite book?
So I listen to a lot of books because I had such a huge commute every day.
Yeah, yeah.
A good book I really liked was called Speak Okinawa by Elizabeth Nikki Brina. And it is her her autobiography, memoir about having an Okinawan mom and a white dad, and and just her cultural upbringing and her relationship with her mom. That was really deep. That was really good. And there's this other one called Nobody Will Tell You This But Me by Bess Kalb. And that one is, it's a beautiful story. Yeah, it's like a mother and child, mother and daughter relationship, and their dialogue and constant, banter in a way, but their relationship too. And I really do enjoy nonfictions like that because it feels real.
Mm-hmm.
But I still do love, nonfiction too. I just finished The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna, which is it's fiction, but it's about World War II French, resistance.
Mm.
Yeah. In, you know, with Nazi occupation. So a good one that passes the time and it is so just fun to just read is the Crazy Rich Asians trilogy.
Oh.
Yeah. I've heard
they're really good. I have not read any of them, but
three
I've heard
books. I mean they're really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to kind of just imagine all the glam of just like the CRA life, the Crazy Rich Asian life. And you know, it's just really sparkly and fun and hilarious what rich people do to try to clamber up the ladder, right? Yeah. And then Trevor Noah's Born a Crime.
Oh, that book is incredible. Yes.
It's so good.
Oh my goodness.
And I want to meet his mom one day.
Same.
Like, she is like, wow. Yeah. Wow. You know, so strong. And somebody like that is just like so inspiring. I love how it, you know, it wasn't really about him. It was, you know, how she raised him too.
Right.
So, I mean, someone like Trevor Noah, can you imagine like him? But I mean that, but then, you know, he has a mom like that.
Right.
Like,
wow. Of course, it's like, of course he does.
Of course, right. Yes. Like, not surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you know, I like it's easy to, you know, go into celebrity, you know, memoirs or biographies, but like that one stuck out to me a ton. He just has some great stories. So
great story. And the end of it is also just like has this sweep. I don't even remember exactly, but I remember it being like this, it crescendoed to like this incredible ending. And I was like, yeah, it was one of the best things I've read in a long time.
Yeah. He definitely carried me through the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next question. Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Yeah, but it's in Japanese.
Okay.
Because you know how karaoke is very different in Asia.
It's competitive, I've heard.
Well, no. I mean about the non-competitive, normal culture with your own private room.
Oh no, I don't know if I know about this.
When you go karaoke, you don't sing in front of strangers, like you do here.
Oh, okay.
You're like, you're at the bar and you're, you know, everybody sees you in the mic and the screen, right?
Yeah.
And whatever state you're in. If I was in America and I didn't have any Japanese selections, it would just be Don't Stop Believing Journey. Mm-hmm. And I will dictate the entire solo to you.
Sweet.
Right?
Awesome.
I just have to.
Yeah. Of course.
No matter how many drinks. Mm-hmm. And then
even zero drinks, you'll still do it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. Like all of it. That's just how it goes. Yeah. it's part of the piece. I mean,
that's part of the Ari Isomura journey experience.
you will taste every note. and it will be right.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what's the room thing though? You're talking the private room portion.
Oh yeah. So you pay by the hour, and of a room, and then you know they so you would go in with your friends, no matter how many. I think maybe some other karaoke places they would charge by how many people are in there, mm-hmm. But generally it's by room and hourly by room. So, you just pack it in. And there's, there's a chair a sofa that's along that is the whole wall, right? Mm-hmm. Two walls makes an L, and then the table for all your drinks and beverages and food, and then the screen, and you know, it's really intense. So people would go karaoke with your own group, and so you would sing in front of your own friends. And you know, if you hear a sound leaking from another room, right, then you can kind of judge them and be like, oh, they're only singing this one band or something like that.
I see.
But you know, the commotion is private and it's like separate, right? So then a lot of shy people can get their practicing in. They're singing in and without having to sing in the shower, you know, where your family can hear you. But yeah, you can just go to a karaoke place. So that's very different than here where you have to. You've seen in front of everybody.
Yeah.
People go to town for that show for sure. But yeah. There are some karaoke wait, what city are you in?
I'm in Columbia, Missouri, where University of Missouri.
Oh, okay. I feel like there would be some karaoke boxes there.
It's not that big. So, I mean, it's like 100,000. So
Okay.
It would be, it would, like, it's usually, if we do karaoke, it's usually at a, like, we have a friend who has, who he's Filipino, just happens to be, but he's got his own,
Filipino.
So, so he'll bring it to parties and we'll just be singing in front of each other, which is totally fun. Yeah.
Amazing. So. Yeah. Those, they have those Bluetooth karaoke mics now where you hook the mic. It's a cordless mic and it's Bluetooth to your phone. And so the speaker is going to blare out the instrumental YouTube track and then it's going to amplify your voice. So there's some portable things, but I bet your friend's system is going to, like, it's a hefty and necessary item for every party, I'm sure.
Well, the only problem right now is that it's old enough that it requires like an old, it doesn't have like an HDMI. It's not like it's like the system before HDMI. So the last time
we used it. VGH or something?
Yes. Yeah. So the last time that we used it, we had to pull out our old TV so that could hook up to it and we could sing that way. But he's got the two mics and he's got like the flip book that's got everything in it.
Oh, wow.
But I think it probably came out like 2010 or something like that. So it doesn't have all the most recent music.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's still a lot of fun, and we're all old, so it's all the songs we know are in there. So
yeah, that's the thing. You don't really need to look for new things anymore because all the ones you like are already in that. You know, they're all in that machine, so you don't need to buy any more new ones.
Very true.
Yeah,
that's awesome. All right, where is somewhere that you have not traveled to that you still want to get to?
Spain. Yeah, that was gonna be our honeymoon.
Oh.
And we haven't gone yet. See. So, but I mean, we got married in 2021. That was still like pandemic days, and it was not something that we really wanted to research and like get ourselves to step a foot in Madrid or anything like that. But.
Sure.
Someday it would be nice to go to Valencia, the other nice places, and Greece. And
you did it with the diphthong. Is that what that is?
But the thing is, I don't really feel the need to go as much, because, where we went in 2022. So my husband is Chinese Indonesian. And so his family's all in Jakarta.
It's,
you know, 12-hour flight to Japan, 8-hour flight to Jakarta, right? And it's just,
and it's a massive place, right?
Oh gosh, yeah, it's a whole other world for sure. He found, so we hung out with his family and everything, and that was all cool. And his brother also got married too, and that was all fun. So I went to an Asian wedding as well, which is just a very different culture. Being in America and all of a sudden, like, if you see one white person, you're like, what? So it's very different. It's flipped for sure. So on Instagram, my husband found this travel resort thing and place. And we went on a motorboat for a speedboat from Jakarta for an hour and took us to an island where we were the only ones for two nights. And we had our own chef and our own crew, like snorkeling crew and everything. We had the whole island to ourselves for that long. Yeah. And like 4 or 5 course meal, 3 meals a day. Right. Yeah. And all like delicious food, Indonesian food. Wow. And that whole thing. And we, you know, we were in a hut. Like it's those resort ones where there's no, and then your bathroom's outside, but like it's pretty, you know, it's like bougie, right?
Yeah.
So that whole thing, you know, 3 days, 2 nights was only $600 for the whole thing, you know, and it's just like, well, I'm kind of set. we're fine, yeah. You know. But yeah. Him finding it on Instagram and then communicating with that resort on WhatsApp, I was like, this is where we die. Like,
right. Yeah.
This is where I have seen in public for the last time. Like, no one will ever see me ever again, you know. But then I came back, so it's fine.
Oh my God.
It just looks so sketchy. Ugh. Like, this is how it is. You know,
so. Well, you're probably the almost until like you're there, you're just probably staring at your husband like,
yeah.
Just like, little really? Shakes like, I am going to, like, even if we get off this island, I am going to kill him. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That was a little scary, but it was worth it for sure.
Yeah.
Awesome. So anyway,
last couple, strangest, okay. Funniest, or most bizarre performance moment that involves you.
Well, luckily I haven't had any terrible ones or crazy things. Well, let's just say I can just think of one that shaped my life direction.
Okay.
That was back in seventh grade.
Okay.
When, you know, we were playing the also Sprague Zarathustra introduction, Space mm-hmm. Odyssey, right?
Yep.
And it's a huge timpani solo.
Yeah. Right?
And luckily, the eighth grader was playing it. And then the band concert happens. He doesn't show up.
Right? Oh.
So, band director comes up to me. Well, another group is still playing and it wasn't our turn yet. You're playing it.
Uh-huh.
Like me, I'm just like, you know, 5 feet tall with like Harry Potter glasses. And I'm just, you know, scared. So scared.
Yeah.
And it worked out. Yeah. So that was a scary moment for sure. But I certainly, and it wasn't strange or wild or anything. It just is a big core memory for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's great. All right. Last question. One piece of art, and it could be, you know, books, movies, podcasts, YouTube clips, theater, visual art, poetry, anything, has impacted you the most recently. And you can, I'll just follow up and say, you can, it doesn't have to be recent. Like you could use your own version of recent.
I was in New York a few years ago and I went to the Andy Warhol exhibit.
Mm.
And I bought a tote bag that says, art is what you can get away with. So I thought that was something that was very memorable. So.
That's good. I don't know that I heard that from that that quote from him.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how he felt when he was creating all his stuff, but in a way, you have to give yourself a little more credit sometimes. What you can get away with, like, it's about them. It's about who's interpreting your work.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have to keep creating. And if it works for them, cool. So,
yeah,
that one's fun. It's not a piece of art, but yeah.
No, that's good
for sure. Yeah,
I like it.
I forgot to plug one thing. For 10th Wave, I wanted to mention that people, if they want to hear 10th Wave, there are plenty of virtual concerts on YouTube. And one that's intriguing is a percussion ensemble concert of all female composers, which is something that is rare, I think.
Yep.
There it's mainly women of color as well. So, yeah, I hope more people can see those because during the pandemic, we were able to make more virtual concerts. Like that, because we want to make music more accessible to everybody. So another one is chamber music and ballet, but it's more modern though.
Okay.
So we collaborated with a choreographer, a ballet dance choreographer, Yuki Tokuda. And there's plenty of marimba in that as well. marimba.
Excellent. Yeah.
So yeah, just wanted to mention that. Yep.
Awesome. All right, Ari, we're done. Thank you so much. I so enjoyed chatting with you tonight.
Thank you. Yeah, the same. Thanks so much for great questions. That was super fun. And hopefully this is enjoyable to listen to as well.
I think so. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. I didn't even bring up, we talked for as long as we did, didn't even bring up Matt McClung. I mean, that could be its own podcast right there, probably.
he's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. It was so much fun having Ari on the show. What a treat. I wish her all the best going forward. All things teaching, 10th wave, motherhood, marimba time, all of it. Thanks again, Ari. This week's rave is the 1975 film Nashville, starring, in alphabetical order, Karen Black, Ronnie Blakely, Timothy Brown, Keith Carradine, Shelley Duvall, Jeff Goldblum, Barbara Harris, and Lily Tomlin, and directed by Robert Altman. Available wherever you get your movies. I've mentioned in this space before that this semester, I'm teaching a course called Intro to Soul and Country. I've been reading and watching and listening to a lot of music and information and movies and documentaries and this and that, and revisiting some items I'd taken in before teaching the course, but I hadn't seen in a long time. And this film was one of those, it's been a while, items. Nashville frequently gets listed as one of the great movies of all time, and this time around, I can certainly see why. The movie was directed by Robert Altman, one of the great filmmakers in American history. His works include, among many others, the movie version of MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, The Player, Kansas City, Shortcuts, and Gosford Park, among many others. But this is his best work. To say that the movie is sprawling is an understatement. The cast is massive and seems to be attempting to say something about Nashville as both a hub of country music, a hub of the South, and a city of chaos. Altman intended to make a film about country music and the city and meant it as an homage, but some folks didn't really take it that way. As I've definitely learned teaching the Soul and Country course, the outsider perspective is a regular figure of dislike to those inside the industry of country music. And someone making a film about country music, but being outside the system, was likely going to be treated poorly. It didn't matter. Altman made a masterpiece. The film is long and busy and chaotic, but you are never bored. Additionally, though it is long, it's partially because it involves scenes where country artists perform entire songs and sometimes long sets in indoor and outdoor spaces, including in the Grand Ole Opry itself and a local recording studio. The best decision that Altman made regarding the movie was to have his country stars in the movie, including Keith Carradine, Karen Black, Timothy Brown, Barbara Harris, and Ronnie Blakely, write and perform their own songs. This may seem like an odd decision until you realize that, relatively recently, this is exactly what Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga did for the newest version of A Star Is Born. And while they wrote and performed the songs, the instrumentalists involved were all well-known Nashville session players, making it an authentic experience of a sort. The best-known song from the movie was the one Oscar that this movie received among many nominations, that of the song I'm Easy, that was written and performed by Keith Carradine. It's a really good but standard singer-songwriter song you typically hear from the 1970s that would fit right in with works by Kris Kristofferson or James Taylor from the same time. Another song from the film that is, for some reason, not on the soundtrack, but really tremendous, is called Since You've Gone. It's sung by Keith Carradine and the two bandmates he's leaving in the movie to pursue a solo career, Christina Raines and Alan Nichols, and fits completely into an Eagles sound. And Since You've Gone is written by... Wait, really? Written by Gary Busey? That Gary Busey. Huh. It's really good. The real gem of a performance, though, was Ronnie Blakely, playing the famous singer Barbara Jean, who has a habit of singing great songs and being perpetually sick. Blakely also writes a lot of music for the film and was basing her character of Barbara Jean on a combination of country icons Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton, along with lesser-known country singer from the 1970s, Lynn Anderson. She's tremendous throughout, and my favorite track from the entire film is her song Dues, which is sung during a concert given on a riverboat. There's a lot of other great scenes, particularly with Lily Tomlin as a singer and housewife, Barbara Harris as someone trying to break into the scene while escaping a terrible marriage, Timothy Brown as country singer Tommy Brown, seemingly modeled after Charlie Pride, and a lot of other folks. But it's the chaos and music and pace that really make for an incredible total package. Available on Prime Video and likely elsewhere, if you're willing to put in the time, you will definitely enjoy Nashville. Find it and watch it. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud and Spotify and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and X at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll catch you next time. Until then.